Welcome to Public Health United, a podcast about improving communication between public health professionals and the public. I'm your host, Nina Martin.
Welcome back to Public Health United. I am here with some really cool people, Dr. Paul Yi and Harris Sayer, who are co-directors of RAIL, Radiology Artificial Intelligence, or AI Lab, here at Johns Hopkins University. Welcome onto the show.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Nina.
Thank you.
So when I heard about RAIL for the first time, which admittedly was only a couple weeks ago, it sounds so cool because artificial intelligence is all over the web right now. We're hearing about it. We're seeing like robots on television, like really cool things. And here I learned that we have this cool research, very collaborative research going on here with radiology and other divisions at Hopkins. So can you tell us a bit about what is RAIL and how did it come about?
Yeah, sure. So RAIL, as Nina said, it stands for Radiology AI Lab. And we're a multidisciplinary lab of computer scientists, of physicians, of graduate students who are really trying to bring the best of both worlds that we have at Hopkins, you know, engineering expertise, medical expertise, so that we can apply artificial intelligence towards clinically relevant medical problems. And the idea really was to create synergy, because as good of coders as we might be tinkering around, we're primarily doctors, and you know, likewise for the engineers, they might know a little bit about medicine. So we really believe in bringing in the strengths of both sides. So we're partnered with the Malone Center for Engineering and Healthcare, which is a center on the engineering campus that's really designed to catalyze this kind of relationship. We work with a variety of different specialties, primarily radiology, because Harris and I are radiologists. But we're working with ophthalmologists, neurosurgeons, and orthopedic surgeons on a variety of different topics. And we work with graduate students, undergrads, and even have some high schoolers involved.
Yeah, and then just as a little bit of a history, about 2 years ago, there were a few of us that were interested in applying artificial intelligence into specifically imaging. And there's another co-director of RAIL called Dr. Ferdinand Huey, who is also in neuroradiology as I am. And independently, Ferdinand had talked to Paul about his interest and then me with my interest in artificial intelligence. And so we all got together at that point and decided, okay, how do we start really from scratch, right? We had no resources. We were interested in this field, but none of us really had any expertise. We had some fundamental understanding of what we wanted to do and what the field was about and the importance that this field would have into the future of imaging. But we got together and then, you know, little by little, we had a lot of people that were interested in this general field as well, asking about, okay, you have a group that's starting, you know, how can we participate? And really, Paul took the lead on that and took it from 0 to 100, like extremely, extremely fast. He got together a core group of people that were able to provide technical expertise. Along that, Ferdinand Huey has networked really well with, you know, different groups. And then along the way is when we started formally partnering with the Malone Center for Engineering and Healthcare. And since we started, I think we've made some pretty significant strides with, again, led by Paul. A lot of grant funding has come in, and we're working on some really exciting projects. And then the group has grown from the three of us to now we have a mailing list of probably a good 40 people-ish.
That's great.
Yeah.
It's always good when it goes beyond just you and your close colleagues to others as well. So I have to say, I wouldn't have at first put together imaging and radiology with AI. What's the thing that you're most excited about right now that's combining the two?
Yeah, so I see two main areas that are very exciting. One is more practical and the other is more intellectual. The first side and the practical side is there's a lot of things that radiologists do and physicians in general that we do each day that don't really require a lot of the highly technical skills or specialized skills that we've developed. These include things like looking up in the medical chart for a patient's symptom or counting nodules on a lung CT scan. These are basically white dots, and honestly, I could probably train a 10-year-old to count up white dots on a black lung. So I think that the potential to automate these tasks, which, you know, frankly, make us feel kind of burned out mentally, takes a lot of our time, that to me is very exciting because it can make my work more meaningful, more efficient. But on the other hand, I think that intellectually, You know, when we talk about deep learning, which is a form of machine learning, where computers are basically identifying patterns for themselves. It's not an engineer telling them look for pattern X, Y, or Z. It's them figuring out, you know, what's the signal within the data. And so there's potential for these algorithms to have superhuman vision, if you will. So as an example, one of our friends and colleagues at the University of California, Irvine, has done work exploring the potential virtual biopsy for brain tumors. And they're finding that they can have accuracies up to 94% for predicting what the genotype is or the specific, you know, gene pattern for these tumors is just based on MRI images. And that's something that, I think human neuroradiologists probably wouldn't be able to do with that level of accuracy. And so from that point of view, I think that the potential for superhuman ability is really exciting.
Oh, wow. So I didn't know you could tell more about the tumor just by, you know, radiology.
Yeah, and, you know,
maybe
jumping
I'm a
onto,
bit ignorant there.
Jumping onto some of the comments that Paul made, one of the exciting things about some of the work that has been done is that they've been able to find things that people have not paid attention to before as well.
Yeah.
So in my opinion, we're really good at pattern recognition, but then so are AI algorithms. That's what they do. They're really good at pattern recognition. What AI algorithms cannot do is understanding what those patterns really mean, right? But going back to what Paul was mentioning about our colleague, the work that he did was interesting because based on the morphology of the tumor, the algorithm was able to figure out some specific genotypes of the tumor itself. And then when he looked at, okay, what kind of features actually predict the different kinds of genotypes, then there were certain features that were predictive, really. And then so then people started looking back and saying that, oh, you know what, if I see this feature now, then it should mean that this is of a specific genotype. In other areas of medicine, that's something we often do anyway. But in this specific instance, it was the opposite, where the AI algorithm actually showed people, you know, what features you could look for.
And, you know, I don't know much about the deep learning, but can you, like, educate the AI how to start recognizing what those patterns mean? Or is it just going to always be pattern recognition?
So,
like, will they learn beyond the algorithm or not?
Nah, they don't learn beyond the algorithm. Because
okay.
What the algorithm is doing is you give a set of inputs, and then you give a set of outputs that you know to be correct initially, right? And then so given the set of inputs, this is an output.
Okay.
And then the deep learning part is all kinds of internal computations that figure out what is the relationship between the input and then the output. And what it does, and why it's called deep learning, is because there's what we call layers of neurons, in quotes, that mimic how brain neurons are organized. Not 100%, but what it is that, let's say you have a set of, you know, 10 brain cells that are connected to another 10 brain cells that are then connected to another brain, 10 brain cells. So it kind of stacks up, and that information then is computed mathematically so that, without going into too much technical detail, essentially the values of the relationships are set of those layers. And then so between the input and the output, then you can figure out what those values should be to make a correct, to have correct results. So beyond that, it's not going to tell you much is the problem.
Yeah, and I think maybe a more intuitive way to think of it is, like, you know, the way I describe it often is it's like giving a child who has never seen a dog or a cat before a bunch of flashcards that have a dog or a cat. And basically they try to, you know, guess yes or no. And depending on that, they kind of go and tweak all of the neurons in their brain. And another way that these neurons can be thought of are these are feature detectors, meaning that, you know, on the lowest end of the layers, these are detect very kind of simple low-level features like lines, edges, that kind of thing. And then with each subsequent layer, these become more complex because these low-level features are combined to start making curves, to start making, you know, different shapes. And then successively become more and more complex to where you can start seeing maybe a nose, and then more complex to start seeing a face, and then finally you can actually make out dog versus cat. And so that's a very high level, kind of simplified way of looking at it, but, you know, that is kind of what's going on from an intuitive matter too.
Yeah.
And one interesting difference, actually, so there's a lot of, I would say, hype about AI and imaging in general, right? And a lot of people have talked about AI replacing what people do, especially in imaging, that kind of stuff. But what where people are really good at is learning from few examples. And that's something that AI has not been able to do too well. Currently, the algorithms that are available, you do need quite a few examples to train. And then it would specifically be able to generate an algorithm based on those specific examples. So one issue in the medical field, for example, is that if I start a project that I want to do, let's say I'm looking for, you know, head bleeds, simple thing that people have already done. But then I have a set of cases where there are patients who had bleeding in the brain, and I develop an algorithm. There's no guarantee that it's actually going to work anywhere else.
I see. Wow, thanks for that. I feel like pretty ignorant after speaking to you. This is really fascinating, though, because this is a much different application for AI than I've seen on TV, which, you know, I have very limited exposure to.
What is it that you've seen on TV?
I guess on YouTube there are these videos of, like, these robots that kind of learn how to speak and tell people. And so that's why I'm so fascinated to learn about other applications of it. And so is this all, we'll try to put a photo of your lab up there, but is it all, like, done via just computers? So it's just computers hooked up to the MRI machine or to the imaging itself?
Yeah, the computers are where we do our work in terms of algorithm development and all that, right? But the imaging is part of our clinical system. So if we need to train an algorithm, then we would take the clinical information, obviously through all completely legal means, right?
Oh, yeah.
Going through the IRB, all that kind of stuff, and then anonymize them, organize them, and then we would dump them onto a server, a computer, so that we could run the algorithms.
But what I think is interesting is that we're actually kind of, in a lot of ways, riding on the coattails of the tech world. You know, deep learning has been around for probably about 7 years now. 2012 is, I believe, when the first modern day deep neural network came out. And really, it's been used by Google, by Amazon, Netflix, etc., for a number of different things. Whether it's figuring out what face is on your iPhone, or trying to predict what type of movie is good for you, Netflix. And it's only been in the past few years that radiology has really started to apply this. And in fact, there's this concept called transfer learning, where we're basically taking these algorithms that were used to train Google's algorithms for figuring out what type of image this is. And then we apply that towards the radiology images. And so I think that that's, to me, kind of interesting that although this is cutting edge for radiology, we tend to be, honestly, probably about a year to two behind, what's cutting edge. But as more radiologists are interfacing with engineers and computer scientists, I think that gap is going to start to get smaller and smaller. So that's another thing I'm really excited about, is this intersection of the tech world and radiology. And in fact, we're starting to see, collaborations. NYU has an official collaboration with Facebook designed to make MRI image reconstruction faster. Google has their own slew of independent research projects for lung cancer screening on CT scans, for diabetic retinopathy screening on photographs of the eye, for skin cancer screening on photographs of the skin. And so I think that it kind of runs a spectrum of how tech and medicine are going to interface. So that's something that I think is something to note too.
Oh yeah, I didn't know that Google and Facebook had a piece of the pie as well.
Yeah, yeah.
That's cool. And now I see why you need to have so many collaborators as well. So when you got into this, how much did you know about deep learning?
That's a relative question, right?
I mean,
we're always learning.
Nobody.
Right, we're always
nothing.
Learning. And I think for each of us, we had varying levels of knowledge about deep learning. I'm more of a hobbyist programmer, so no formal education in it or anything, but along the way, for my own other research, I had to learn how to use MATLAB and Python and that kind of stuff. So very simple algorithms I could train. That was my level of knowledge, really. Some of the people who are in our group actually have no knowledge if we're on the medical side. Some of them actually have pretty significant knowledge even on the medical side. Yeah,
and I personally came in with zero to none. I was actually a big skeptic of AI and the advent of, quote-unquote big data in medicine. A lot of doctors, we kind of think our work is too complex to, possibly simplify enough to be, computed. But I had a friend who, mutual friend, basically sat down with us one night at dinner and convinced me that this is going to be the next big thing. He told me about how it's already making waves in ophthalmology. And so I came into this as a skeptic who became a believer, and that's actually been the experience of a lot of our colleagues. But yeah, so I came in with a kind of traditional clinical research background, and I tackled it kind of from that approach of how can I, as a clinical researcher, investigator, how can I apply this towards, you know, these problems? But along the way, it's been a lot of fun learning more of the technical details. But again, as Harris said, I think that as much as I will ever acquire in terms of knowledge in my lifetime, it'll probably just be a fraction of what, say, a PhD in this area knows.
What's really interesting about, you know, the environment now, over the last couple of years, there are algorithms that actually learn which algorithms to use as well. So that's pretty exciting, because I think the algorithms are getting easier and easier in general to use. If you have a system whereby, you know, you just feed in data and then it automatically tells you, okay, based on the data, this is what you should use, and it just goes ahead and uses it and then trains it for you, then really the middle black box, what we call, there needs to be less and less of expertise in that specific domain. Not to discount people that, you know, are experts in this, because there will always be a role. But for very specific instances, you know, for example, some of my colleagues who are interested in applying deep learning to some of the problems that they have clinically, it would be so nice to make it easier for them so that they have data, they can just plug it in somewhere, and then an output is generated. For simple questions, that probably could be done.
Yeah, because I was going to ask next exactly this, like, how far are we from taking this technology and putting it out more widespread?
Well, so people have already started implementing AI in actual clinical use. So looking for strokes, for example, head bleeds. And that there are some institutions that were already using that as in clinical practice. So it's already started, really.
Yeah, but I think that we're a long way from having this be certainly standard of care. You know, the FDA, honestly, is still trying to figure out their policies about, you know, how do we actually evaluate these, you know, new tools for safety, for efficacy, et cetera. Radiology departments, I can say at Hopkins, one thing that we're actively trying to figure out is, and this applies to all of radiology, actually, is, you know, what's the appropriate way to actually vet these things? Because in medicine, we have this kind of so-called quality kind of metric type of thing that we do, where we have to evaluate, you know, the procedures we're doing, the tests that we're running, all of the different things that we do, and see, one, is it safe? Two, is it effective? And three, does it actually save money, or does it cost money? And so with AI, I think that there's a whole unique set of things to monitor. I think even if we had the best technology, that's not the only piece. There's the practical component of how do we translate this? How do we make sure it's safe for patients? Mm-hmm. And that's another thing that I think is important to realize is, you know, unlike figuring out your face on a Facebook photo, the stakes for getting something wrong in medical imaging or, you know, any other type of medical AI are much higher. So whereas you might accept a certain amount of error for telling you if, oh, that's me in that photo, I think that for medicine, for most categories, even a small amount of error is probably not acceptable.
Yeah, we can have catastrophic consequences. And, you know, some of that goes back to what I was mentioning before, in that an algorithm developed with a certain set of data may not translate. It's not generalizable to all data that it may be thrown at, right? So that's the vetting process that Paul was talking about, is how do we actually ensure that, you know, an algorithm is generalizable and then it's being used in the correct way, really.
So how long have you been co-directing this?
2 years.
Two years.
Yeah, just shy of two.
And so working with such an interdisciplinary team, I mean, it sounds like you, Harris, had a lot of experience with coding before, even at an amateur level, let's say. But how is it to integrate with such a team? And are there communications issues, different languages? How's it been?
I wouldn't say there's communications issues. I think that's where understanding the coding helps, because you can communicate with, you know, the actual technical experts about fine details. And I think Paul's actually found that out too. And he's actually learned very quickly how to do the coding part as well. And the communication that we have with our engineering group is, to me, very easy, because we both understand each other's perspective. And the engineering group specifically, is a group that is interested in engineering and healthcare. So it's called the Malone Center for Engineering in Healthcare. So the director over there, Greg Hager, he knows, you know, the issues that are occurring in the medical space and brings in his engineering expertise. From us, it's the opposite, is that we bring in primarily the medical expertise, but we know enough about the coding engineering side to communicate, really. So that's been really good.
Yeah, but that being said, that doesn't mean that it's not always so straightforward, because it is hard to translate, you know, complex clinical problems that for me and Harris are very, you know, just second nature to, you know, an engineer. And likewise, for an engineer, something that's very rudimentary or basic, sometimes for myself, I'm like, oh, I'm sorry, can you explain that? So I think that one of the things that I've, you know, I think that we've learned is that it's really important to have a group of individuals who have different skill sets, but you all have to be aligned on the same mission. Because if we had engineers who were just looking at this as pure data, just a way to kind of, you know, run a bunch of fancy models, but without trying to understand our end of it, and likewise, I don't think that we would be as successful as we've been, and ultimately wouldn't be able to, you know, do the things that we hope to do.
And that's a really interesting point, because initially when we started out, that was one of the major questions that the engineering side had. And what the issue was for them is they would get a lot of requests from a lot of people, because people had started learning about AI and how to, you know, use that in medicine. So they were getting a lot of emails and requests about, I have this data set, I want to do AI, and this is kind of what I want to get out of it. And Dr. Hager, actually, when we had the initial communications, he mentioned to us that he didn't know which ones were actually clinically relevant and important. And he really valued the input that we were able to provide him, saying, yeah, this project seems like it would be of value for whatever reason. This other project, you know, maybe not so much, so that they could titrate their workforce to, you know, spend energy on the correct thing.
Yeah, I'm really interested in team dynamics these days, because, you know, I think a lot of people in science and medicine are moving towards these interdisciplinary teams, but at least doing my PhD, we were not trained to talk with people from other fields, and sometimes I feel like we are speaking a different language. And, like, I know I work in science communication now, and there are 10 different words that mean the same, like, concept. But depending on which field you're in, it's a different word, which has been very confusing. And you do learn over the way. So just one more question on that. So what are some other things that you think are helping to make this a successful interdisciplinary team?
I think there's a lot of things, right? It's really multifaceted. When we initially started, I think we had a certain idea of which direction we wanted to go as a group. But along the way, you know, growing pains or whatever it is, we had to kind of reassess what we needed to do for the organization and what efforts we really wanted to spend our energy on. So that was very important. And also to make sure that we are utilizing each individual's best traits, best characteristics to the best of their abilities. Paul is really good at doing certain things. He's actually good at everything, but he's really, really good at executing. I've never seen a person that can execute as well as he can. You give him a task and then 5 seconds later it's done, right? As for myself, I have some skills that are helpful to the group, mainly on the managerial side of things and organization side of things. And then Ferdinand, who's the other medical co-director, he's extremely good at networking and getting buy-in from outside, you know, individuals or groups and building the excitement about the organization. So we all have our different roles that we've been able to work with, really, to make the group better and bigger.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say, too, also plugging in the multidisciplinary side, I think that Greg and Matthias Umbaroff, who's an assistant professor at the Whiting School of Engineering, who's also our main partner, they also kind of complement each other well, too. I look at Greg as kind of being similar to Harris, like a master strategist. He kind of sees the big picture, and he has had a lot of experience. He's the former chair of computer science. He's directed a lot of international focus groups in computer science and computer vision. But he kind of, you know, sees the lay of the land, and he's really able to really kind of understand what's going to appeal to the computer scientists and the physicians in the room, and ultimately what's going to be the synergistic effect for clinical care. But then Matthias is just technical, you know, brilliant. And he understands the clinical parts, actually. He probably understands, for instance, intraoperative or intraprocedural imaging a lot more than I do, despite my being a radiologist. And so I think that we all bring something unique to the table, and that's where it's been good, because although a lot of people might look at us and say, Harris is so different from Paul, who's very different from Ferdinand, who's very different from Greg and Matthias, I think that what we have found is that there's strength in that. But I think that that really is dependent on having an open line of communication and a mutual level of respect and trust that, you know, each person is going to kind of operate in their own way, but towards this unified goal.
I saw on the website that you mentioned that the collaboration is in an open structure. What does that mean?
Well, so if people have, you know, ideas, projects that they're interested in, then we welcome anybody to come to us and then say, okay, here's an idea that I have. And honestly, what we would try to do is to find the resources available to help them execute that. And that's one of the main principles upon which the group was actually founded, is that we were trying to get people, like-minded people together that were interested in this space, and then just grow as a group. And I think, you know, going back to growing pains, along the way, we realized that there has to be some kind of structure, right? But again, the core principle is still there, in that we want to encourage everybody who's interested in this to come and reach out to us and, you know, just work on exciting projects.
That's really awesome that that's one of the philosophies, because I think also from, you know, that's where the innovation comes to. It's about being more open and having new people come in.
Right.
So I think we're just about out of time. Is there anything else you wanted to add? Anything I forgot?
Well, for those of you in the Hopkins community, Harris and I are part of the planning committee for the Johns Hopkins Research Symposium in Engineering. And our topic this year is AI in healthcare, from bench to bedside. And so basically we're bringing in luminaries from, you know, all over, from radiology, from medicine, from startup world, to Hopkins to have a discussion about, you know, what are the challenges, what are the hopes, and what are the opportunities for bringing AI into, you know, clinical care. And so that's going to be happening on Monday, on November 25th, right before, it's the Monday before Thanksgiving. Look up Malone Center Research Symposium. You should find a registration link. It's open to the entire Hopkins community, and it should be a good time.
Oh, that's really, really cool. And we'll make sure to have links on our website as well, so people can follow it. But thanks again for your time today. It's really cool to learn about Rail. We can't wait to see what happens in the future about it.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having us.
And listeners, please check out the website for the resources, www.publichealthunited.org. And we'll talk next time.
Thank you for listening to Public Health United. Please visit our website at www.publichealthunited.org and like us on Facebook. This is your host, Nina Martin. Listen, communicate, unite.